Yeah, House Revenue Committee will, for today, will March 27th, 2007, will come to order. We have a public hearing on six matters today. We're going to open five of them in public hearing because they're all related to a variety of issues involving taxes, tax expenditures, and the like. And so we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2922, House Bill 2963, House Bill 3108, House Joint Resolution 26, and House Bill 3260. And our first, we're going to, would you give us a review first of HJR 26, and then we'll hear from Representative Greenwood.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. HJR 26 amends the Oregon Constitution and requires the legislature to authorize income tax expenditures for no more than 10 years at a time, and then refers the amendment to the ballot at the next regular election. And currently in there, the time period, the 10-year time period for the tax expenditures would be from January 1, 2010 through January 1, 2020. So all of them would be done in a block of 10 years at a time.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Greenwick.
Thank you, sir. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenwick, House District 33, and I appreciate your hearing HJR 26 today. I certainly don't have to outline to this committee the question of the extent to which we have tax expenditures that far exceed our tax receipts. And many of the tax expenditures we love, we should love, because they serve valuable purposes. I mean, I have my own set of favorites, but the home mortgage deduction is one. I think it's great that home ownership is great, although we ought to restrict it to maybe one's home rather than to one's yacht or whatever else can be a second home. And I like charitable deductions. I like a variety of them. But the fact is, it's very complicated to find a way to look over the whole range of tax expenditures and determine periodically which ones make sense to continue and which ones don't. A group of freshmen in the 2003 session got tax expenditures on our mind quite a bit, and we had a variety of proposals to deal with the revenue shortfall in the forthcoming biennium, including an across-the-board reduction of 10% of all tax expenditures for the next biennium, and a whole set of alternatives on how to deal with the question of making sure the public policy objectives that we have when we put tax expenditures in place remain in place over time. Now, not all tax expenditures, in fact, most tax expenditures do not have sunsets in them. And if you bring up a tax expenditure and try and reduce it, it requires a 3/5 vote to eliminate a tax expenditure because it's a revenue increase. It only takes a majority vote to put tax expenditures in place. And that imbalance seems like a big problem. So what HJR 26, after discussions with legislative counsel and with others of my colleagues, does is attempt to even that playing field. It does two things. It requires the legislature, by constitution, because this would be a constitutional referral, to put a sunset on every tax expenditure for 10 years so that no tax expenditure could be in the books with a sunset longer than 10 years or with no sunset at all. And the intent, of course, would be to create a fifth of them expiring each biennium, so that over a period of 10 years you would have reviewed all of the tax expenditures, and it would require a positive majority vote, just a 31 vote, to put that tax expenditure back into the books. Most of these would be pro forma. It might provide a little more work for the Revenue Committee, but we're not about to take away the charitable deduction. We're not about to take away what's excluded by this, anything that we're required to do by federal law or other kinds of things. So we wouldn't have to look at all of them. But what it would do is create what seems to me a public policy good, it would require the legislature at least once a decade to review a tax expenditure, ask what public policy it serves, and make sure that it continues to serve the public policy that's intended, and to submit it for renewal with another 10-year sunset, and all it would require would be a majority vote to renew it at that point. It seems to me it's one of the solutions. You have other solutions in front of you. There are, what, five bills, did you say, that you just opened a public hearing? They all tend to address this issue, and I'd like to see it addressed in any of these ways, but this simply remains my contribution to the discussion, and one that seems judicious and rational and not excessive. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll end my testimony. I thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions for Representative Greenlick on this measure? I have only one, and I think that the text of the measure answers it, but I wanted to make certain that we're talking about the same issue. Lines 26 and 27 of the measure authorize the legislature to authorize tax expenditures, and it could do it for up to 10 years or for a lesser period of time, as I read that. Is that your reading as well?
No, it could. I think the point of that section is you wouldn't have to wait 10 years to renew it. So after 4 years, if it made sense, you wanted to look at, say, the charitable tax deduction, in 4 years or in 6 years, you could renew it for another 10 years. You don't have to wait for the 10 years.
Okay, that takes care of the issue of ongoing long-term planning for business capitalization and a variety of other things of that sort. Thank you. Are there other questions for Representative Greenlett? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony very much today.
Thank you. Thanks for hearing it.
And Representative Buckley has joined us. Representative, we're open on six measures now, and I think one of them is yours. Why don't you come forward?
As reluctant as I am to follow Representative Greenlick in any capacity, given the comparisons made. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, House District 5. I appreciate your consideration today of House Bill 2922, and I'll be very brief. Representative Greenlick framed, I think, in a very articulate way, the difficulty we have with reviewing and ever pulling back on tax expenditures. It's such a huge part of our budget, and we're faced now with the co-chair's budget. That, for instance, in my case, if I look at where we are headed for community colleges and for higher ed, my district's in tremendous pain. The Rogue Community College issued a press release yesterday saying they're going to lay off 24 full-time employees, including full-time faculty members, if the budget that is proposed is the one that eventually is adopted. Southern Oregon University in my district is in terrible financial shape currently, given the lack of funding that's been provided over the past several budget cycles. So to my mind, it's a very simple proposal. We're asking to take a look at some specific tax expenditures, to review them, and to ask yourself, are these tax expenditures more important to the state right now than funding higher education, than funding community college, than funding services for the developmentally disabled, to funding domestic violence programs? What is the best expenditure of our resources to benefit the people of our state? And that's the question I wanted to bring to you with these specific targeted tax expenditures for your consideration. As Representative Greenlick did say, it would take a supermajority vote to pull back on these tax expenditures and to direct them in a different way in the budget. And I strongly urge you to do so. I do have amendments being drafted that quite simply, if the committee is willing to consider them, that would create a Oregon Revenue Recovery Fund and designate, and of course Ways and Means will change it any way they want to, but that this committee could designate any money returned via the ending of these expenditures and target them towards community colleges, higher education, developmentally disabled services, domestic violence programs, which are my priorities, but I would, of course, be interested in talking to the committee about their priorities as well. But that is an amendment I would propose, that we would actually be willing to pull back on these expenditures and redirect this use of Oregon's resources towards programs that are vital for our state.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Byrne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I wouldn't know the answer to this question, so maybe I don't know that you would either, but I'll ask it, just to get that on the table. Do we know what the annual amount is, or the biannual amount, roughly, of these tax credits are costing the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, yes, we do. There will be representatives in the Oregon Revenue Coalition who will be testifying after me on this bill. Lori Wilman-Wareland will be testifying with a chart that she's developed that shows a grand total of $294 million for your consideration.
Per biennium.
Per biennium.
Okay. Yes.
Thanks for following. Only coffee.
And a follow-up. I absolutely understand and appreciate what you and the other sponsors of this bill are trying to do with this, and I agree with the basic tenet. Everybody's little tax credit that comes along is like, wow, that's great. It's only $1,000 a year or something like that for an individual. But when you start putting them all together, like, what did we create here? My concern is, and it doesn't argue against this bill or another proposal similar to this at all, but my concern is that these tax credits that we've sort of let grow over the years, the many years, has reduced our ability to go after fundamental tax reform, which a lot of us, or if not all of us, agree has to happen too. And so I don't know if you agree with this or not, but my only concern is that if we don't do them together, and I think they ought to be done together, and I think they both ought to be done, if we separate them out, it makes doing each, well, it makes the tax reform piece even more difficult to accomplish. I think with this, as part of a broader look at comprehensive tax reform, we get there, we provide the revenues that we know the state needs, and we can start looking at a little more, sterner eye, if you will, at some of these tax credits. So that's basically a comment, but I'd love to hear your comments on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, actually I'd have to agree with you. I think that's a great point to make, and I believe that by starting the process, by actually showing that we're willing to review tax expenditures and reverse direction, I think that will create momentum for overall tax reform in our state. I think people will look at it and say the legislature's serious about this, they're serious about coming back to almost a blank slate again and building back up to a system that is actually fair and actually meets the priorities that the state has.
You sound like Steve Forbes when you said that. I just want to let you know. Thank you.
I practice my Steve Forbes impersonation usually on Tuesdays and Thursday nights. Yes.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions for Representative Buckley? Thank you. A great introduction to this bill. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay. We have... Yes. Well, I think that what we'll do... Thank you. Chris is going to go ahead and review the rest of the bills that we haven't actually reviewed, and then we'll take our witnesses.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the other three bills remaining are House Bill 2963, 3108, and 3260. 2963 essentially attaches a sunset onto most of the personal and corporate income tax expenditures, except those required by federal law, the Oregon Constitution, or to avoid double taxation. And it repeals a handful of tax expenditures as well. And it also creates the Oregon Tax Expenditure Commission, which would essentially evaluate the tax expenditures, provide that oversight. And most of the sunset dates are January 1, 2012. House Bill 3108 directs the Secretary of State to conduct an audit on tax expenditures, and the bill also requires the interim House and Senate Revenue Committees to review the tax expenditures at least once every 6 years, essentially a third each biennium, with a third of them being reviewed in the 07-09 biennium. House Bill 3260 extends by 5 years the sunset dates for most of the income tax expenditures scheduled to sunset in the 07-09 biennium. The exceptions there are pollution control and the alternatives to field burning. So we essentially have a bill that puts a blanket sunset on everything, as well as requiring some oversight and review of the efficacy of the tax expenditures achieving their policies, and one that directs the Secretary of State, as well as interim work done by the revenue committees to do the same function. And then the most restrictive, if that's the right term, of the bills simply extends the sunsets for the bills that are going to sunset in the 0709 biennium. So those are the themes there.
Thank you. Questions for Chris? Thank you. I think since she was already mentioned, we'll go ahead with Laurie Wimmer Whalen, who I think is here on the same bill. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Laurie Wimmer Whalen, representing both the Oregon Education Association, its 46,000 members, and also the Oregon Revenue Coalition. And you'll receive my written testimony on the coalition's letterhead today. We are actually in support of most of the bills that you have opened up today, but I'll speak specifically about the one that Representative Buckley has brought to you along with several colleagues. And it's our thanks to him and also to all of you for taking this time to consider this issue, which we have been pursuing for four biennia now. And for those of you who have tolerated my testimony on this particular issue for all those years, thank you for your indulgence once again. We have, at the Oregon Revenue Coalition, created a document which we're in the process of updating that many of you may have seen. It's our primer on Oregon's tax expenditures. We produced it in 2003 and did a presentation before the revenue committees on our theories about the tax expenditure booklet and the policies of the state of Oregon. The good news is that when we first started this, we had 58 cents of every tax dollar levied was foregone in exchange for the balance going to program of 42 cents, and now we are down to 56 cents on the dollar, and 44 cents goes to programs at the state and local level. The bad news is, back then it was 350 tax breaks, and now we're up to 362. So I don't know if that says that we are unsuccessful or not, but that is the fact of life now, that you have 362 on the record, and a number of those are passed because, as I've said before, they represent good public policy, and a number of those are passed because they have a really great lobbyist. We believe that it's in the state's interest to take a look at those tax expenditures and consider for repeal or sunset those that do not seem to serve a good public purpose or do not seem to aid beneficiaries in a way that's cost effective. For example, if there's a claim of job creation from inducement given with tax break, we'd like to see those jobs, and we'd also like to make sure that that you buy them for the right value. If it costs more to create the job than the salary that's earned from that job, it doesn't seem to be an efficient use of taxpayer dollars to forego those dollars as a program. With respect to this bill, you'll see that I attached to my testimony a chart. I've got to make a correction that I found out just moments ago was now no longer in the book. There was some concern about the inventory property sales source exception. The tax expenditure books that said it was erroneously included, and they've taken it out in this doom book, but there was some confusion about whether it was still on the books or not. So you'll have to back out the $20 million I assumed in that. And so I guess the total revenue that would be produced from the cancellation, not considering that particular tax break, would be then $274 million. Still a significant chunk of change, particularly given the post-secondary education need for more resources than may have been suggested most recently. We know that despite the fact that we have come out of the recession and its aftermath, we still don't have adequate revenues, and hard and painful choices are being made by your colleagues in Ways and Means. And this would be one way to answer the call by some to improve particularly the post-secondary budgets and some of the other vital services that Oregonians value and which may not be funded or funded adequately in this current look at the budget for the 0709 biennium. So we look forward to the work of this committee as you look at all of these bills, whether it's to scrutinize, review, sunset, cancel, whatever. We consider all of them valid ways to manage the tax expenditure program as you manage budgets. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Lori? I have one. There's a, because of the way we've opened the hearing, there are lots of ideas on the table. We seem to be talking more specifically about HB 2922 as compared to other things. Are there some of these that your coalition considers to be particularly troublesome that we still have them on the books more than others, or are all of these ones that you would recommend that we simply repeal, or what's the view of the coalition on that issue?
Mr. Chair, we would defer to your judgment. We've recommended these as a suggested list of some of the low-hanging fruit, the things that we think, as you've seen, if you look at my chart, I have a comment section that shows, for example, the first one, the income earned abroad by U.S. citizens being exempt up to the $80,000 threshold, and also housing being exempt. The evaluation of this break is thin, and the chief benefit is listed to be to help Oregon attain an international frame of mind. And when you consider that we're buying that frame of mind for the tune of $32 million a biennium, we would suggest that those kinds of rationale might not be in the state's highest interest.
Thank you very much. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori, you may remember this as well, but I served on this committee several sessions ago when a previous chair decided to embark on the gargantuan task of hearing virtually every single tax break that we had. And nothing fills the hearing room as fast, it seems, as doing that. And by the time we got through, I think the only ones that actually didn't survive were a couple that were antiquated and hadn't been used at all. So my question to you would be, what do you think it actually would take to start seriously considering some of these? Because just sunsetting them doesn't seem to really do anything other than, I mean, make them come forward and justify themselves, but doesn't seem to result in elimination based on the numbers you're giving us.
Other than a larger hearing room, what would it take?
Yeah, that's right.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenbaum, I do remember those hearings well, and there's a soldier at every pot of money, and of course money is what gets people's attention in this building, both in the Ways and Means Committee and the Revenue Committees, for different, very different reasons. And perhaps one way to do this is to combine the sunsets with clawback provisions for those that are renewed. And clawback provisions are mandates that the program be able to demonstrate that they do what they say they're going to do, particularly with respect to job creation at an efficient scale. And if not, they lose their tax break for that reason. I mean, to my way of thinking and to that of the coalition, if you can demonstrate that you are serving that higher public purpose and you've got data, in other words, you're accountable, then it makes sense to keep it. And I think if that kind of green eye shade analysis is puts these to the test, rather than just trust us, what's good for General Motors is good for America kind of argument, then I think you would have a number of them that were retained, but those that don't meet that test wouldn't be. And that's the same thing we ask of programs on the budget side.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you. Yes, Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, this probably isn't so much in the form of a question as just a concern that particularly when we pick out and we parse out the federal tax code and make Oregon unique from not most other states, but all other states with regard to certain things relative to investments and like-kind exchanges. I lived through the time when Oregon said, we will come and get you if you do not replace your residence in Oregon. We will have you pay the tax if you move your residence outside of the state of Oregon, thus making Oregon the only state in the Union at that particular point. And incidentally, that was ultimately, many years later, determined to be unconstitutional. But in the process, Orida Foods said, we do not want our headquarters to move people out from our Heinz headquarters to Ontario, Oregon. We would rather go to Boise, Idaho. And Boise is a great place to do business. They've got a more even tax system with sales tax and so forth. But I don't want to live in a state where, because it becomes, number one, a full employment act for all accountants, and number two, it becomes a situation where Oregon has parsed out its tax code in such a fashion that it actually says your business headquarters is not welcome here. Don't move executives into this state because we're going to get you when you do.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, actually, I would like to comment on that if I might. I think it's fair to say that we want to be careful with how we proceed. I think also it's fair to say that 49 other states are probably also looking at these kinds of policies. And finally, I think it's also fair to say that in the last 7 years of disinvestment in public education due to our hard times, that too sends a message to corporations that have executives and trained workforce that they're trying to bring into the state if they're already here or consider moving or expanding here, that they want to have a vibrant K-12 and post-secondary education system as well. That when we've looked at the data on that, most corporate executives say that that's by far more of a consideration for relocation and expansion decisions than is tax policy, because state tax policy is such a tiny piece of their overall expenditures, whereas their personnel costs are gigantic. And I think that when Dr. Sims came to Oregon a couple months ago, he had a slide in his PowerPoint presentation that showed you that dramatic difference between the two. So those kinds of, when we're looking at tax expenditures, I think we also have to think in terms of the revenues and how they could be deployed by this body to support the public education infrastructure that does attract business.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. I have several other people who want to testify on one or more of these bills, and without knowing more, we'll just take them from the top. First one is Chuck Huebner and Will Garber. Oregon Audit Division. And I bet you want to talk about a different bill.
Yes, I do. Chair Barnard, members of the committee, good afternoon. As you well noticed, House Bill 3108 does have our name mentioned, and I thought I should probably come down and comment a little bit on that. I'm having sent around my written testimony. I've also included for the record, Chuck Huebner, Director of the Audits Division. With me today is Will Garber. He's the Deputy Director for our Performance Audit Division, who would undertake such a Herculean effort were this bill to pass. Again, the House bill that we're wanting to talk about a little bit is House Bill 3108, and I've got my written testimony there, and also I've included a little bit of work that we have done over the last little bit, primarily at the urging of Representatives Dingfelder and Rosenbaum in an audits committee meeting we had at last biennium. They were holding up the tax expenditure report and commenting on how the information wasn't particularly as helpful as they would like it to have been. So we took a look at it again. We had looked at tax expenditures before, trying to decide what we could do from an audits point of view. I did attach a little bit of the summary work that we did around that. It does give you a little bit of an overview. We call it a capstone analysis of what we found in looking at primarily at the tax expenditure report. And I also included in there an interview that we conducted with the state of Missouri, who had been tasked by legislation to look at tax expenditures and basically to opine on whether or not they're effectively achieving their purpose. And it does provide a little bit of insight into how difficult that is to do as a state auditor, as an auditor. There are many parts of the process and tax expenditures that auditors could possibly add some additional information for you. The sort of information is provided in the report in terms of numbers that are reported to you. We could look at that and make sure that the numbers being reported are accurate and all of that. Even in the delivery of some of these tax programs where they are administered, and there aren't a lot of the tax expenditures that are on the books that are actively administered. Most of them are more passive in nature. There are a couple where tax certificates are issued, and there are processes to be reviewed, and potentially we could look at those processes and find some efficiencies in the delivery of those sorts of things. But the big question we keep hearing is the effectiveness question, and the ability to tie cause and effect to a specific tax expenditure is troublesome for us. It is a matter, I think, more of economics than it is of auditing. finding that direct tie between a tax break for pollution control or energy efficiency and the willingness of an individual to go out and buy a hybrid car or a new refrigerator and say that they're directly related, that they wouldn't have bought the refrigerator if they didn't have the tax credit, or they would have bought a bigger one or a smaller one or two or whatever. I'm not sure that we've been able to feel comfortable that that sort of criteria exists in a form that an auditor can take the independent criteria, apply it, and come up with that definitive answer for you as to whether it's achieving its purpose. And in looking at the report, you know, the experts in this area, I think, have some trouble trying to provide that sort of information for you as well. You look at each tax credit. Some take a stab at it, and you look at it, and you kind of say, well, how did they come up with that? And others, there doesn't seem to be an attempt. So I guess, to make a long story short, and I'll let Will add anything he may want to add, we just feel that bigger question is not a question for the Secretary of Audit's Division to try to answer for you. I'm just not sure we could get there. There may be pieces that you may decide you want some assurance on, but the ability to tie cause and effect to a specific tax credit, I don't think we're going to be able to do for you. And that's why we're fairly neutral on the bill, but you know, with a headache on the horizon, I think, if it were to go through in its present form.
Thank you.
Don't have anything to add.
You're here to
support.
Okay, for backup.
Questions.
Yes. Questions for this panel.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, gentlemen, for your comments. I guess the thing that disturbs me, though, is, and I was recently again looking at the tax expenditure report, is when you read these evaluations, I mean, they're so seemingly superficial. They virtually never say anything critical about any of these programs. I mean, I think they're just sort of boilerplate. They all say they seem to be accomplishing, you know, the intended effect. And so it just, although it's a great idea, it doesn't seem to me that it's really giving us feedback that is particularly useful. And so I think what we're searching for is some other tools that could be a little more effective.
Yeah, Chair Barner, Representative Rosenbaum, I empathize, because when we looked at this, at the same sort of thing that you're mentioning, how possibly could we add to the discussion? And the, kind of the mechanism we chose this last time through is to look at the report and say, what, you know, it seems to be asking for all the relevant information that could help a decision maker determine what they might need. But how do we go about verifying that what's in there is correct? Of course, the top lines, the numbers, and, you know, number of tax credits claimed, those sorts of things, or if the data collection process is in place, that should be easy to verify. The purpose, the intent, hopefully you could go back to the legislation and divine that, and hopefully it's specific enough that when you do the underlying analysis that you can address that specifically, and it's not always the case, as if I'm remembering what we're looking at here. And then that last analysis, you know, is it achieving its purpose? We looked at some of the statements. Well, how would we ever verify that? How would we ever? The more we looked at it, the more scared we got. You know, it really was an economic model. And if you look at what Missouri is doing around some of the more revenue related, the fiscal related tax credits that they're looking at, they've got this economic model where they can plug in their assumptions and you know, come out with some sort of equation. They'll tell you number of jobs and the sort of economic impact you may get from that. The word assumptions bothers an auditor, number one, because, you know, we like certainty, and the more assumptions you put into it, the more explaining you got to do about your results. So hopefully there's very few, if no, assumptions that are being made. So that, on the one hand, is an issue for us. And the other thing that I did note when I was rereading that Missouri study was that the tax credits that were more behavioral in nature, you know, trying to cause people to do more better things, the assumptions they didn't think were going to work in that model. So there they are, left with wondering, how are we going to ever definitively say that the tax credit is achieving its purpose, if it's to get more charitable deductions or buy more inefficient cars or whatever. So I empathize. I'm not convinced that it's an honest question. We're more open to continue to discuss it, but I'm just, it just worries me.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the comments of Chuck are demonstrative of the fact that We had thought, as a revenue committee, working in the interim with former members of the committee and current members, that perhaps it would be a good idea to, number one, make sure that all credit and tax expenditure discussions were couched in terms of actually having sunsets, and so that we could come back and in a few years and determine whether or not they were being used appropriate those appropriately and those kinds of things. Second thing, and Chuck is really has really hit the nail on the head as far as I'm concerned, and from the accounting background, it's easy to talk about what you think might happen, but there's always the question, who came to town and brought their businesses because they were just coming anyway, irrespective of what you did. So the measurable performance is something we've talked about for the Revenue Committee to examine as a part of further extensions of new credits or existing credits, and Chuck, we're still trying to get our arms around. So I think that that's the enigma is, how do you plunge a thermometer in it and actually have it give you a temperature that says, yes, you are getting 10,000 new jobs as a result of exactly what this credit does.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the concerns that auditors have about certainty in placing value judgments, and I would assume that with some of the tax expenditures, it would be much more difficult to do a neutral, non-valuated judgment. But I'm wondering, I think this just jumped out at me from the handout from the previous speaker, $216 million per biennium for the life insurance investment income. And it seems like that's the type of thing that we would be able to look back in time to the point at which that started to see per capita how many people were purchasing life insurance policies and how many more, after spending $260 million per biennia, were buying, and what was that impact on the economy? Was there a reduction in poverty or loss? Are there other mechanisms that we could use? I'm thinking of the metrics that we adopted with some of our new tax credits. Where would you recommend that accountability piece come in a long way, not just when we get to the point to decide whether or not to extend the sunset, but to determine this is something that's really worked or this is something that this hasn't had an impact on life insurance, and yet $216 million would more than solve the problem that we have in the community college budget?
Mm-hmm. Chair,
and then some.
And then some.
Yeah.
I said more.
Yeah, Chair Barner, Representative Gelser, I don't know if I know specifically the answer to that. I think you're right. Probably some of the credits will be easier to measure if the specific purpose is listed there. If the import of the credit was to get more people buying life insurance, if that's what the credit was about, I'm not sure I'm understanding that right. You know, that may be the result of a tax break. That may be the result of 9/11. You know, it's when you get into those social science models, it's hard to say that the specific action was a result of one specific tax break, I think. But I would suspect that there'd be some that you may be able to do that with, but we didn't see very many in the 352 tax credits that we looked at in our last little review.
Thank you. So if I could paraphrase, and I'm because I want to make certain I understand your testimony, it sounds to me as though there are really two kinds of issues you're raising. The first issue is the difficulty of finding a way of measuring the effect of some of these based on the fact that they're intended to have social effects rather than direct financial effects.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. The other one is, and I think you said this, although not directly, that there perhaps other agencies that are more directly responsible for the subject area might be better at reviewing the effectiveness of the tax credits or other tax breaks in that particular area than having the audit division work on that. Did I hear that correctly, or did I miss that point?
Chair Barnard, I think you're extrapolating a little bit from what I said, but
yes.
I think you're in effect right. The report itself, the governor's report, it does state in the front. And I didn't verify this, that the agencies most affected or related to the tax credits will put together the evaluation. So the evaluation component or the lack of is probably the direct result of the people in those policy areas that have the tax credits affecting them. So I would say that probably the initial evaluation of something like that would be best kept to the experts in those areas, and an auditor, you know, like we do with a lot of things, would come in and verify the information in the report if it's at all possible. And for that last line, I'm you know, and even looking at the evaluations that are in there, I'm not sure we could even evaluate a lot of those because of the sort of things you mentioned, the behavioral aspects and those sorts of things.
Well, to follow up on that, one of the things that the committee has been doing, and this is not original in this session, it's been done in previous sessions, it may have been when Representative Butler was chair, I'm not certain, that the committee's adopted a rule as part of its committee rules that essentially says that before it recommends the adoption of any tax credit or the extension of any sunset on tax expenditures, that the committee will understand what the purpose of the expenditure is, and we've added to that at least in the way we've operated on it, and established some ways of measuring whether or not that purpose is being met. Would those kinds of things properly executed make it easier for the Audits Division to evaluate the tax expenditures if that was actually done?
Chair Barnett, I'd say absolutely, but the question is, can it be done for some of these credits? You can probably come up with a methodology for almost anything, but it's got to be meaningful, and you know, and I'm not sure that is possible for some of the tax credits. And I'm not an expert. You know, you probably would want to defer some of your LRO economists on that, who deal with these sort of tax issues all the time. I'm just telling you from an auditor's point of view, looking at some of those things, that it seemed difficult at best, if at all possible.
Thank you very much. Does that raise anything else, Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I vowed to keep my mouth shut, but I can't stand it.
Please.
Let me speak very specifically. I couldn't agree more with the gentleman here on how complicated it is to evaluate over time who and what and how these things work. Let's take case in point, the life insurance investment income piece. I'm a recipient.
Yes.
Okay, why am I a recipient? Not because right now I need a life insurance policy, but when I was at home with children, no earning income, not putting anything away from retirement, this was a wonderful vehicle to both life insure me in case something should happen to me and my husband is suddenly left with three small children, and put away money for in a tax-deferred investment. Now, I know there are other women out there in that circumstance who ought to be looking at this right now. Or maybe there's some other vehicle that's better right now. But every time you go into one of these, you're going to find people like me all over the place who are using these things. And and these blanket statement, it doesn't seem useful. Look at it. The minute we point a finger at one of these, this room will fill. Okay? And this is one just I know personally why I used it and what I used it for, and I would like to have it available for my daughter, to tell you the truth, because she's in that circumstance right now. So I just be careful what you're asked for here. It may be a can of worms you just don't want to open up, and we need to be very strategic in this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm through.
Thank you, Representative Berger. And, of course, you pointed out the set of problems we face with dealing with any of these, especially the ones that have larger dollar implications. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably a question, before I make a comment, to Chris. Chris, do you know how this is calculated, this cost of $216 million? That's deferred income is what it is. You have that's just the current rate on the amount of income that's deferred in the annuity policy that Representative Berger was talking about? Is that what it is?
Representative Butler. I believe it's shared from a federal estimate. The Joint Committee on Taxation puts together an estimate. I don't know the details of that, so they produce federal estimates. And then how many of these are done, especially if they're federal exclusions, because that means they don't show up on a tax return anywhere. They are shared down to Oregon using some comparisons between the Oregon tax system and the federal tax system.
Mr. Chair, let me just share with you what's going to happen. When she's a ripe old age, Representative Berger is...
Which is years in advance.
And years in advance. A long time from now. She's going to have that annuity set aside, and she's a very frugal person, and she's not going to have expended it. And what's going to happen is she's going to die. And that's called income in respect of the decedent. And none of that is taxable to her, but 100% of it is ordinary income to her heirs. And they pick it up in a different fashion. And so we say, oh, no, we're losing $216 million today, but how much are we picking up on IRD? Now, if I knew income in respect of the decedent, if I knew the dollar amount of IRD and was able to plug it in, the tax that we were collecting on IRD, because I happen to know that every day somebody dies with a fairly significant amount of annuity that's uncollected that will pass into the next generation, and it's not like getting a step up in basis in the lot next door. It is an ordinary income item, and you have the obligation as an heir to pick up the tax on it, and you have a very short period of time in which to do it, usually 5 years or less. And so if we had the ability to come back and say how much IRD is being taxed in Oregon, I think you'd and then subtract that amount from this 216. Because usually the next generation that's picking it up are picking up other assets from mom and dad. Usually they're picking it up in a pretty high bracket, and all of a sudden the amount which we have lost as Oregonians as a result of some of these things are coming home.
Thank you. Others? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Senator Westland?
Yes.
Are you here for this hearing?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
He just lost his way.
He just lost his way.
I'm working for the next bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. But I can be if you want me to.
We appreciate that. Andy Clark, Oregon Association of Realtors.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Clark. I'm the political affairs manager for the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I appreciate being here today. I'm here actually to testify in opposition to House Bill 2963. To be specific, I'm here to testify in opposition to a specific provision in Section 38 regarding the mortgage interest deduction and its connection to the federal tax code. The legislature has done numerous reviews of tax expenditures, which is well and good. A periodic assessment of tax expenditures to evaluate their usefulness is good government, and OER appreciates the committee's vigilance and sense of duty to Oregon's taxpayers. But I did want to talk a little bit about the mortgage interest deduction itself. As the committee considers potential changes to the tax code, we urge you to consider carefully the social and economic benefits that the mortgage interest deduction provides. People don't buy homes necessarily because of the mortgage interest deduction. They buy homes to satisfy social, family, and personal goals. The deduction does, however, facilitate home ownership by reducing the cost of a mortgage. The 2007-2009 Oregon tax expenditure report states that 591,000 Oregon taxpayers lowered their taxes by nearly $391 million using the mortgage interest deduction. And according to the National Association of Realtors, 60% of the families who claim the MID have household incomes between $60,000 and $200,000, making it hard to argue it's a tax giveaway to the rich. The Oregon Association of Realtors aggressively supports the mortgage interest deduction because it helps people become and remain homeowners. We urge the committee to recognize that a home purchase is, number one, the largest investment most families will ever make, that it builds wealth, provides tax revenues for local governments, and stimulates growth in all housing-related industries. The deduction remains the most effective tax incentive to expand home ownership, which remains the heart of housing policy in America. Plus, the deductibility of interest paid on mortgages is both a powerful incentive for home ownership and one of the simplest provisions in the tax code. It shouldn't be targeted for change. I'm going to stop right there and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Would you say again what section of the bill you're talking
about?
That
was section 38.
38. Thank you.
Of House Bill 2163.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clark, tell us, the committee, if you would, how you feel about the interest deduction on secondary and recreational residences.
Our board hasn't taken a position on that, but I'm more than happy. Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, our board hasn't taken a position on that, but I'll be happy to take that back to our Government Affairs COG and provide you an answer.
Thank you. And the question I have now is for staff. I think the federal book used to break that out as to how much mortgage interest was on primary residence and how much was on secondary residence. Do they still break that information out? And do we then access that for Oregon?
I don't believe they do break it out, but I can double-check that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Other questions? I think you've been very clear. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Kathy Eaton, League of Women Voters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization which encourages citizen participation in government. We very much appreciate this opportunity to comment on the issues of tax expenditures. The state of Oregon, as you've heard, literally gives away billions of dollars every biennium. Tax breaks, credits, deferrals, and deductions. Some have social and economic merit, some do not. The League for some time has advocated for a serious review of these tax expenditures. In the meantime, there continue to be new measures that expand the list. 150 of them have been currently proposed. These proposals stretch from agricultural equipment exemptions to employers' wage increase credits, from affordable housing credits to volunteer public safety service credits. Four would extend the life of pollution credits. At this point in time, we oppose House Bill 3260 that extends the sunset dates for income tax expenditures for the next biennium, particularly because it would extend the pollution tax credits. And the League has been opposed for all of these benefiting interest groups for many years. We are concerned about H.J.R. 26, which deals with legislative oversight over a 10-year period, partly because the League believes that the Constitution is the framework for the structure of Oregon government, and we don't believe that this is the type of material that should be in the Constitution. House Bill 3108, which directs the Secretary of State to conduct performance and audits of tax expenditures, you have just heard some testimony about the difficulty of that being done by auditors. And 2963, which would extend tax expenditures not required under federal law or the Oregon Constitution, and would continue the Oregon Tax Expenditure Commission to review expenditures. And we're very concerned then about the extension, continued extension of tax expenditures. It's been interesting to listen to the discussion today, and because it is difficult for the review. We understand that. We've been here for four sessions now talking about some way in which to determine which of these tax breaks are good, which are not, which are useful, which are some kind of window dressing, if you will, that has a cost to it. It seems to us that the crux of this matter is to determine, if it's possible, the purpose for which this tax break is given in the first place. According to law, there has to be a purpose for a tax break to be extended. What is that? How is it being used? The evaluation we've heard session after session doesn't not give viability often to a tax break, but it's hard to say why, if you got the tax break in the first place, why was it there? To what purpose was it given? If you can find an answer to that, we certainly would support whatever you can come up with for the evaluation of tax breaks, but we are looking at the need to review this, however you can determine in a good way to do that. Now, every state agency in their budget is now required to look at why it has spent the money the way it has. What services and programs did it provide? What was its purpose for being? And one of the new buzzwords, if you will, is best practices. What are the best practices that are being done to do the performance that is required? So somehow, what the League is asking you to do along with other, with all these other groups over time is to look at how we can enhance the state's ability to provide services and programs by recapturing some of the money that we give away with tax breaks. However you can come up with an answer to that, we certainly will support and help you in any way we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Are there questions for Mrs. Eaton?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Just a thought. Kathy's testimony on this and other bills reminds me of the old saying that a new broom sweeps clean. And I'm wondering, Kathy, if really the only way that we're ever going to get this thing revamped, as you've heard testimony today, that we can fill the room when you just talk about even just a couple of these going away. If Oregon's system, I've sat here and you remember the time, I used to do it when I was much younger. I used to file my state income tax return on an IBM card. That was it. It would say, how much is your federal tax, and take this percentage and send us the money or receive it back. And that was it. It was, in fact, an IBM card. It was a little 80-digit, 13 places, I think, 13 or 14 different fields on it. And we've come from that time to the time where a simple Oregon return, I noticed that my return, even I just received it back, even with the OPC scanning, my current return, my current Oregon return, without any Oregon, without any federal schedules, will still be 10 or 12 pages long. My concern is that I'm almost to the point where if we're going to do something, we're going to have to change materially. Suggestions? Incidentally, Kathy, I have a little file upstairs that says it's time to change Oregon's tax system. And every time I get something, a new idea on a single sheet of paper, I'm not going to put in a book in there, but every time I get a new single sheet idea of ways of changing Oregon's tax system, I stick it in that file. Can you help me?
Representative Butler, you raise a very good question. My husband and I are in the process of putting together isn't going to be 12 pages long, but it certainly is longer than it used to be. I wish I had a good answer for you. The problem is we're giving away a lot of money every biennium. And sometimes we talk about that fact that Oregon is bleeding this money because we could use it in other ways if we could capture it. I certainly don't have any answer to the best way to do that, but we have to figure out some way to do it. And when we say we like it done in a reasonable time length, I'm not convinced that we can do it that way, but I think you have to figure out a way to get at this. Even if it is, you know, 10 years seems like a long time, and we don't support that timeline because that's a long time. But in the long run, if you can put together the methodology for looking at those 362 tax breaks and determine how long that will take, and then start doing it. Now, the Oregon Revenue Coalition, as Lori has pointed out to you, has determined that there's about $275 million that, if you use a phrase that some of us do, you pluck the lowest fruit on a branch and see what you can do with it. But there are problems even with that. So you have to start somewhere, and merely extending the breaks into the future until you figure out some way to deal with it. I personally would not feel that, nor the league would feel that was a satisfactory answer. You really need to start now and bring in some minds, good minds if you can. You have people suggesting various things. But if the laws that set up each of these tax breaks, when they were determined, said this is the reason that this tax break is being given, there was a reason why, then there should be a way of saying, is that still a viable reason? Now, for the social and economic tax breaks that are given, we understand that there is a real purpose for that service or that program to be done. But there are many others where that purpose may not, at this time and date, actually being realized.
Thank you.
A long answer.
Further questions? Representative Gelser?
Yes. What is an IBM card?
Oh.
It's nasty.
Oh.
Found the gap.
I love it. As a fellow member of the Under 35 Caucus, I appreciate that question. Representative Beller, would you like to enlighten us? Or, you know, just leave that.
You bet. I've got a whole bunch of them upstairs. My parents had the IBM cards that they had left over from the days of working. But that's how all information used to be stored. The fields, there were 13 fields, there were punch cards, 13 fields high, let's see, 0 through 9, and then 3 alpha fields up above, and those combination, and then the card was, as I recall, it was 120 fields wide, and that would carry information, and you could what we call jack plug a board, that would in effect read multiple cards together and read information off of those cards, and frequently when you would do your accounts receivable run, when you get ready to print your accounts receivable run, depending upon how big of a accounts receivable run it was, the cards were about 3 inches by 10 inches, I suppose, and the boxes were not quite 30 inches long. And you'd load those boxes up on a tray, and you'd just start feeding those in, and it would start printing off information about your accounts receivable or how many students you had at your college and those kinds of things. And that was the storage fields that you had in lieu of fixed disks and those kinds of things. So I'll bring some IBM cards so that everybody will be able to have an opportunity to see some of those. Man alive, did I ever just date myself?
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Butler.
Further questions for Mrs. Eaton?
That's correct.
Thank you very much. Next on our list is Arthur Towers.
And he must tell us, Mr. Chair, if he's seen an IBM card.
Good place to start.
Chair Reed, Chair Butler, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. We represent about 40,000 workers, state employees, caregivers for the elderly and disabled, child care providers, nursing home workers, and indeed I have seen an IBM card. That concludes my testimony. I'm not exactly sure how to follow that last exchange, but I will give it a whirl. I just wanted to testify today that we very much applaud the committee for having this conversation today, holding this hearing, and examining this approach towards solving the state's services problems and funding problems. I look at the legislation that we have before us and look at the dollar amounts that we're talking about. And when you balance that against what the Ways and Means committees are struggling with, and the types of shortfalls that we're looking at, and the types of choices that we're having to make, I just want to remind the committee that what we're talking about here, when we're talking about $300 million, which is what the legislation roughly brings in, you're looking at 600 hours of daycare for 3,000 rural school kids. You're looking at 3 million hours of home care for elderly and frail Oregonians, or about 3 months of that program. You're looking at more than 1,500 opportunity grants for Oregon college students. And, you know, as you think about the various tax expenditures, we just want you to keep that set of choices in mind as we proceed here in terms of trying to recapture some of this revenue. And so, again, we appreciate the direction the committee's headed, and we support the ideas that are before you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Towers. Questions? You've been so compelling. You've silenced us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think that completes. I'm sorry. Jody Weiser is also on our list. I missed the second sheet here.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. I want to reiterate what everybody else has said about how much they appreciate the fact that we're getting a look at how we spend our money outside of our budget, because it's obviously we're spending lots of money this way, and we need to look at it. That there are several items in 22, and I personally have benefited from two of those tax expenditures. I remember when I was going abroad to work and I was told that I wouldn't be paying any federal or state taxes on that income, and it was like, what? And in fact, that's probably the year I used, aside from when I was in a university system that was publicly supported, it's probably the year that I used the most in public services. And yet I had a $7,000 tax break, and it was like, what's the point? Why are you paying my taxes while I'm gone? My assets are at home, and I was at the embassy numerous times in London that year. You know, it didn't make any sense at all that I was getting a tax break because I was earning an income while I was living someplace else. And the same would be said of the ability to not pay taxes when I change ownership of investment real estate. I suppose what happened was there used to be when you sold your house, you didn't pay taxes on it. You rolled it into your next house. And so maybe the investors came before Congress and convinced them that they should be able to do that with their real estate holdings too. But if I decide to sell my MCI stock, I pay my capital gains tax. And if I decide to sell my apartment building, there's really no logical reason at all for why I shouldn't pay my capital gains tax, except that somebody came and convinced some legislator someplace that that was a good idea. And it's a great benefit to people who are getting wealthier, but it doesn't make sense on a public policy standpoint. And I think it's really important that we look at each of these ways we spend our money and consider whether we're spending money in the best way. I also, in looking at all the different bills that are tax credit bills or tax expenditure bills or changing the taxable income bills that are before us this session, many of them look like feel-good items rather than good public policy, or they look like they're benefiting a specific industry rather than being good public policy. So I think you need to look at those issues. But also, I've been surprised at the variation in the tax credits. Some of them you can carry forward 3 years. Some of them you can carry forward 1 year. Some of them you can carry forward 9 years. And I can't see any reason why it would be different periods of time for different bills, except that it happened to be written that way by whoever wrote the original legislation. It never seems to be questioned. Likewise, you can get a tax credit for something and still be expensing it in many bills. Well, that's really double dipping. If you've spent money sending your employee to college, you can expense that expense. You can also get a tax credit for having spent the money. It doesn't make sense. So I think that in looking at tax expenditures, it'd be good to look deep within the bills or within the legislation that created to see if there are inconsistencies internal to the tax expenditures, not just whether the tax expenditure is a good or a bad use of our funds. Representative Butler, you've spoken of the, I think...
IBM cards.
IBM cards, yes, I know what they are.
Okay, thank you. I don't feel nearly as bad, Mr. Chair.
You've spoken of the complexity of our tax forms, but every time we give it out a tax credit, we're creating more complexity. And so if we differentiate ourselves from the federal government on how much house you can have a mortgage on or how many houses you can have a mortgage on, that's for us to do. And, yes, it will make it more complex, but so does a tax credit for volunteering to be an EMT or for subsidizing your employees' education or anything. They all complicate things, and the issue of that complexity doesn't seem to come up when we're giving away money, only when we're taking it back. So thank you. I'm glad you're really looking at how we spend our funds.
Thank you, Jody. We appreciate it. Are there questions? Thank you very much. I don't have any other witnesses signed up for these bills, so we're going to close the public hearing on, House Bill H.J.R. 26, House Bill 2922, House Bill 3108, House Bill 2963, and House Bill 3260. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3530. And Mazin is going to give us the summary, and then we will hear from our two members who want to, sponsors who'd like to speak on this bill. Mazin?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mazin Matic, Legislative Revenue Office. I don't know. What do you feed the IBM card to?
You could have it into a collator. You could have it into a reader.
What's a collator? Well, let's
give you answers.
In the House Bill 3530 is a bill that probably will not come often to in front of you. This is a result of the new incorporation of a new city in Oregon. This is the city of Lapine. And the city had found itself in a predicament in the sense that it was founded by the vote in November. However, it does not have, at the time of its founding, the ability to levy the tax at that time. The statutes, however, because there isn't many examples of this, do not have a solution for this issue. The only solution that came close to it, this happened last session with the city of Damascus that came in front of you. And the city of Damascus was peculiar also in the sense that it was within an urban growth boundary. So the laws within the statutes talk about the urban growth boundary city formation. The bill, as it stands, will take that distinction away, which allows any city that have just formed to use this borrowing mechanism, basically tax anticipation note, for the amounts that they would be expecting in the future. To borrow about 80% of what they expect for about 18 months before they start collecting their property taxes and other revenues. In that sense, also, we have a fiscal report, Mr. Chair, that it doesn't have a fiscal impact. However, when I was reading the bill, in the beginning there was no mechanism of making the bill effective immediately.
And since that was the essence, I believe that there's a dash one amendment. And the dash one amendment makes it an emergency and makes it effective on passage, which allows them to go almost immediately to borrow against that future revenue.
Question, staff.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Mazin, I thought we already had a mechanism in place that if the county clerk authorized a taxing district, and perhaps a city, isn't the city a taxing district?
Yes.
I thought we had a mechanism in place because that happened for the health district in Christmas Valley, that the county clerk could authorize them to use tax anticipation notes. Why is that not the case in the instant issue with regard to the city of La Pine?
Representative Butler, statutes as they stand make those taxing districts within the urban growth boundaries. Taking away the urban growth boundary section within the statutes will allow for that type of borrowing to apply for the city of La Pine.
Okay. Thank you very much for that explanation.
Yes, and if you look on page 2 of the bill, lines 13 through 16, I think that becomes very clear at that point, that there's a specific limitations on cities, and they have to be within urban growth boundaries, and that is the specific language that this bill removes. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to be joined here by Senator Westland. I think
for the record.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Good afternoon, committee, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative 53, which includes the district includes the newest city in Oregon, La Pine, which is in the south part of my district. I think your economist has explained the bill pretty clear. The city of La Pine voted to incorporate themselves in the November election. They elected a city council. The mayor, a friend of both Senator Westland and I, has been paying for the post office box and buying stamps from his own personal account. The governor was made aware of this by Senator Westland and has arranged a $50,000 grant to them. And they've also had a lot of help from neighboring cities in giving them computer equipment and office furniture. And getting them started, but they need some money to hire staff and get going. So we're here to ask you not for any money, but to approve this bill as quickly as possible, so they can get a line of credit against their projected revenue. And as the chair said, we put a dash one in for emergency clause. You don't have that yet, Mr. Chair, I guess.
It's here.
Okay, so. I hope you can have a work session and get this passed.
That's my plan if the bill's ready.
Yeah.
Senator?
For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, and with regard to Representative Butler's comments with regard to IBM cards, I only have to say, Representative Gelser, I know I speak for the entire, most of the committee in the entire committee room when I say shame on you. I just can't believe it. Representative Butler, if his colloquialism, a new broom sweeps clean, well, it's equally true that a new city sleeps broke. And as Representative Wisnett has indicated, this is really a dire circumstance for these good folks down there. They've tried to get incorporated for a number of years. They finally get it. And I've got to tell you, it is really quite scintillating and exciting to watch them as really they construct a new democracy. And part of their issue was financial. And the new mayor down there, Stu Martinez, is a volunteer fireman and just one of the greatest guys anybody wants to meet. He, at first, kind of funnily, you know, humorously said, you know, well, I'm taking money out of my own pocket too, as Gene indicated, by telephone and P.O. box and supplies. And he was saying that kind of funny at first because he's saying, well, it means I've got to buy cheaper dog food. Now he's saying it seriously, that I'm so glad I have been taking that money out of my own wallet to buy the cheaper dog food. Regrettably, based on the tragedies going on nationally. The issue before us is certainly immediacy, and I want to compliment the governor's office for stepping in with it was not a grant, it was a $50,000 loan from the Strategic Reserve Fund, and that's really just kind of, you know, get them through the hump. It allows them to hire staff, which was critically lacking. All these guys down there, real jobs, trying to provide for their own families, were just, you know, it was just chaos for them. Emails were going unanswered. The phone they were finally able to get had a broken answering machine on it, so they weren't able to return calls. It's just, like I said, it was the formation of a new democracy, and it was really quite something to watch. The governor stepped in and got them $50,000 so they can at least hire staff. What this simple bill before you does is allow the city, based on the restrictions that are currently in law, to issue TANs, tax anticipation notes, that will allow the city to receive revenue money based on revenues they will most assuredly be receiving anyway. So with that, I'll throw it open, be available for questions should the committee desire, and urge your strong and quick passage of this bill. Thank you.
In your view, gentlemen, is the bill ready to work if with the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair, it's the same bill we passed for Damascus, minus the deal about the urban growth area. There's no changes to it then.
Right. Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm proposing to vote yes on this as quick as we have a work session.
Well, I have a couple of questions before we get to the work session. I don't know anything about formation of cities, so these may be a couple of not very bright questions, and perhaps we can ask Mr. Shaw when he gets here if you don't know. Where does a new city get tax revenues? I mean, where does it get income from? I understand it won't get any until next November, but where does it get from then?
It's cigarette lottery tax,
gasoline tax,
room tax.
They'll have a property tax base within the city. Takes time for that to get up and running. And it really highlights, I mean, we don't incorporate cities in this state very often.
True.
And so each one of them is kind of unique and an exception. Damascus was fortunate that they were close. I think did they end up getting some money from Metro?
I don't know, Senator, but Mr. Chair, the county, like Senator Wesson said, this, before Damascus, the last city to be incorporated was Kaiser. So it goes back a long time, so we don't have a checklist. You know, my military background, I want a checklist, you do this and you do that, but we didn't have it.
So this city will have a property tax base starting next fiscal year, starting in July.
But
and of course they won't collect any money
exactly
until November, or whenever it is that the assessor gets around to paying it over after that.
It's kind of like $5 isn't very much money, but if you don't have it and need it, it's all the money in the world.
Yeah, that's right.
That's where Lapine is.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you for waiting while we finish the other hearing. We appreciate it. Mr. Shaw.
Good job, buddy.
Afternoon, Chair, Committee members. Andy Shaw at the League of Oregon Cities. Here in support of this measure. We think it's a very simple fix. When the Senate Bill 341 was passed in the 05 session to address this issue for Damascus, that language on the urban growth boundary was included, I think primarily just because it was part of identifying the bill as fixing Damascus's problem. No one realized that this wouldn't fix the City of Lapine's problem until we took a closer look at that statute and realized that they're obviously not within an urban growth boundary. So we urge you to move this bill forward quickly to provide Lapine with some relief. On the question you asked earlier, Mr. Chair, the city will get its property tax revenues in November. That's the normal point at which they would get their revenues. Their population has been censused and will be certified this weekend or on Monday. That's the point at which they can begin generating state shared revenue off of some of their revenues streams. other revenue streams are based both on their budget and on their population. So that has to await a full fiscal year occurring before that can be calculated. So it's a somewhat slow process of getting those revenues flowing to the city, and this would provide them with the ability to borrow some money in addition to the funds that the governor has graciously loaned to the city.
Questions? Will Mr. Martinez be able to stop paying the phone bill?
I believe so. He's also paid for the election that the county held and a few other expenses, which I think in the process of getting the incorporation going, they didn't realize they were going to be facing those costs on the city's behalf.
A new definition of buying a job, huh?
or buying an election.
An election, yeah, buying an election. All right. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on House Bill 3530? If not, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3530.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move the dash ones be appended to House Bill 3530-1 dated March 23rd, 2007.
Representative Butler moves the dash ones. Discussion? Has everyone seen them? Essentially what they do is add the emergency clause. That's the point of this bill, I think. Is there objection to the adoption of the dash ones? Without objection, they are added to the bill.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
I move House Bill 3530 with the dash one amended be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Butler moves House Bill 3530 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? If not, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. The motion is carried, and the bill will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The two choices here, we can ask Representative Wisnett to carry the bill. Is that what you'd like to do? Fine, that's what we'll do.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we close the work session on House Bill 3530. Is there any further business to come before the committee? If not, we are adjourned.